Radio station WHCH, the student-owned and operated radio station of Hofstra College.
You're listening to WVHC FM, 88.7 megacycles.
WRHU, Radio Hofstra University.
Celebrating 50 years as Long Island's premier radio station of higher education, this is WRHU, Radio Hofstra University, 88.7 FM and WRHU.org. As part of our 50-year celebration, WRHU presents The 50 Project. Radio station alumni return to 88.7 FM and take to the airwaves one more time.
Well, hi there. My name is Stephen Mines, Radio Hofstra University class of 1973. During my time at WVHC, I was the promotions and publications manager, the news operations director, and the remote chief. In the years I was at WVHC, I covered news stories like the opening of the Nassau Coliseum and the Great Village of Hempstead dog waste hearing. When the circus came to the old Island Garden Arena in West Hempstead, I interviewed Hugo Zucchini, the guy who got shot out of a cannon. I did a music program. I recorded dozens of programs of all kinds. I edited the program guide. I did almost everything but sports and cleaning the studio. I didn't much care for sports, and they didn't trust me with our big silver Kirby vacuum cleaner. A while ago, I got wind of something called the 50 Project. To commemorate 50 years of Hofstra Radio, alumni would produce 50 hours of radio programming. The response was almost immediate. There was no shortage of guys who wanted to reprise their rock music program, their folk music program, or their jazz show. Guys stepped forward to reprise their sports shows. Nobody, however, volunteered to do a public affairs show. Being a smartass and a contrarian, I told the Hofstra Radio Alumni Association that I wanted to do a newly minted episode of Exploring Management. Exploring Management was a long-running public affairs program produced at WVHC for an organization called the Administrative Management Society. It was a discussion program moderated by a nice man named Franklin Wolfe, whose day job was selling insurance. We'll talk more about that show later. My offer to produce a new episode of Exploring Management for the 50 Project was insincere and snarky, but it yielded me an hour of airtime on what is now WRHU. Instead of doing Exploring Management, I decided to salute every public affairs program ever aired on WVHC. As I pondered this, it dawned on me that this would be an opportunity to do something I'd never done while at WVHC, a radio documentary. Since this was for the 50 Project, I set out to record it with vintage 50-year-old broadcast microphones, Electrovoice 655Cs, the same model that had been used in the early 60s at WVHC and were still in use during my tenure in the early 70s. There was a lot I didn't remember about my Hofstra years, so I turned to a handful of WVHC program guides that I had edited in 1971 and 1972. They became my Rosetta Stone for this project. For this program, I set out to tell a story, starting with a cynical premise. Public affairs shows were awful, but it didn't matter because nobody ever listened. The story I ended up with was very different. It's a story about a bearded, bespectacled, pipe-smoking Pied Piper of broadcasting, miles and miles of quarter-inch audio recording tape, and a line drawing of a bird wearing a top hat perched on top of a microphone. The guy with the beard? He was Jeffrey Krause. He was the guiding force at Hofstra Radio, WVHC, and later WRHU, from 1959 to 1992. He sounded like this.
This is Hofstra Community Broadcasting, WBHC FM and Campus AM in Hempstead, New York.
There's a saying that those who can do, those who can't teach. Make no mistake about it, however. Although he spent a whole career at Hofstra Radio, Jeff Krause could have worked anywhere. To tell this story, I spoke with more than half a dozen grizzled broadcast veterans. One of them is Wes Richards, With a more than four-decade career in New York broadcasting, including stints at NBC News and Bloomberg Radio. Wes is a Hofstra graduate, but not a radio station alumnus. Wes says that Jeff could have had a great career in major market or network broadcasting if that was what he wanted.
Without question, the guy was a major league talent who just never did it. Now, whether that was because he was being truthful about what he wanted to do with his life or whether he was afraid of the insecurities, and Hofstra, for all of its ups and downs, was a fairly secure place to work in those days. Or you know, I can't answer for the inner Jeff. But, yes, he most certainly was as talented as anybody on the air anywhere in that day.
I called Jeff Krause a Pied Piper of broadcasting. How did he affect young people? Bill Weisinger, a Long Island native, knows a bit about broadcasting. He's worked in radio and television in Ohio for over 40 years. He's taught broadcasting courses at Kent State University. He remembers hearing Jeff Krause speak 43 years ago.
I was in my junior year at Lynbrook High School. This was circa 1966-ish. And they had this thing called Career Day, not knowing what else to do. And I kind of liked radio stuff. I saw radio on the list. All right, I'll sign up for radio. And I show up at this room, and at the head of the class was this guy. And as soon as he opened his mouth, I knew I was in the presence of a real radio guy. None other than Jeff Krause from some place called WVHC at Hofstra University. I never even knew that Hofstra University had a radio station. But anyhow, the guy was pretty impressive and sort of sparked my enthusiasm a bit for investigating more.
Jeff's ability to get young people excited about radio was remarkable. In the 60s, he was touching high school students like Bill Weisinger and raising the community's awareness of Hofstra University. How did the university nurture this valuable asset? Wes Richards recalls events in 1968.
The trustees decided there was some kind of a financial crisis, which we had a lot of in those days. They were cutting everything. All the student activities were cut. WVAC was cut. And I'm sure they did other budget chopping things too, but I think eventually they figured out a way to at least fund some of it.
One way that WVHC survived was through the largesse of the Hempstead school system that provided funding in return for its own educational programming. The radio station was saved. Here's a cautionary note. In the late 60s and early 70s, WVHC was almost broke. Funding was always lacking, and the threat that Hofstra University would pull the plug always hung like the sword of Damocles over the radio station's head. In the years since I left Hofstra, that changed. While a lot of this story involves a hand-to-mouth existence with the ever-present threat of extinction, Hofstra now seems to have embraced its radio station. The wolf is no longer at the door. By the time I arrived at Hofstra in 1970, Jeff Krause, as general manager of WVHC, was wearing many hats. One thing he did well was teach young people the craft of radio. Howard Liberman, class of 1974, was once the news director of America's first commercial radio station, KDKA in Pittsburgh. He was at all news giant WINS for 17 years and at Bloomberg Radio.
I would have never gotten into radio and never been on the air if it weren't for Jeff Krause. I started at Hofstra. The first thing I did was a weather forecast, and I was a young kid from Massachusetts. I said there was going to be scattered fog. Everybody in the room started to laugh, and Jeff worked with me to get rid of the accent and make me more palatable as a radio announcer.
Kev Riley, also in the class of 1974, has worked throughout the United States in radio and television as a reporter, anchorman, writer, producer, and announcer. He credits Jeff Krause with giving him his start.
Oh, he's definitely a mentor and had a good ear for talent, or I wouldn't be sitting in front of this microphone, because my first day on campus as a freshman, I came down to the radio station to audition, and Jeffrey Krause handed me some news wire copy, and I read it sufficiently well to his liking, and he said, I'm putting you on the air tonight. If he hadn't done that, I wouldn't have a career in broadcasting. Would never have gone into commercial radio and then into television.
Howard and Kev were only two of dozens of people at WVHC during my tenure who went on to careers in broadcasting and in related fields. On and off-air talent, Grammy Award-winning record producers, film people, a successful novelist, all people who can trace their professional development to Jeff Krause and to a magical subterranean lair in the basement of the Little Theater on the Hofstra campus. Ohio broadcaster Bill Weisinger.
So after hearing from Jeff Krause, about a year later, I hopped in my 1959 Studebaker and drove from Lynbrook to Hempstead, found WVHC in the basement of a building. And this was a dingy, dark, cramped basement, but it was cool in there. I thought the whole radio station was really cool. The impression that never left me was that the sound, the productions that came out of that crummy WVHC basement were very impressive. Even if it was a crummy basement. It was cool.
Kev Riley and I recalled the WVHC studios circa 1970.
You'd walk in and walk through a rabbit warren of narrow hallways into a studio about the size of your kitchen table. And I believe one wall was lined with record albums, if I'm not mistaken.
One wall.
One wall. And then the rest had acoustical ceiling tile stapled to the walls as some kind of sound absorption. There was a double-paned tilted glass leading into the control room on the widest wall in the studio. And there was a table with a couple of microphones on it. And I would sit on the side facing the glass so I could give cues to the engineer when to start the program, when to cut the mic, when to play the break, etc. And it was very small, but remarkably efficient. A lot of the equipment we had was hand-me-down from radio stations in the city where various alumni had worked. There are a lot of the rooms in that basement area, aside from the large studio, were about the size of a closet. The record library was the size of a closet, not really a walk-in closet, maybe two closets in length, a hall closet, shall we say.
The record library was also the home of the UPI teletype machine.
Ah, teletypes. You remember teletypes.
I do remember teletypes.
It was the old kind that constantly made the ticking noise. It had a plexiglass cover through which you could read what was being typed as it was being sent over the wire. And if you ever had to change the ribbons, it was a task everybody wanted to shift on someone else. Kind of like changing the toner in your office copier these days. You wait for some other sap to do it.
Howard Liberman spent as much time as anyone in those basement studios.
Well, it was kind of dumpy. And it was not a very huge facility. The albums were stacked up everywhere you could find a place. There were cart racks in all over the control room. It was not elegant. It was pretty much a hovel. But it was a hovel that we spent a lot of time in and really enjoyed.
In the early 1970s, before there was an Americans with Disabilities Act, Hofstra University prided itself on making the entire school accessible to the disabled. Wheelchair ramps were to be found everywhere on campus, or almost everywhere. Howard Liberman recalled snagging an interview with wounded Vietnam veteran turned author and anti-war activist Ron Kovic.
We were doing an interview with the guy that wrote Born on the 4th of July. He was, I don't remember if he'd been speaking on campus or how we ended up getting him, but he was very public at the time. And I remember it led to a whole discussion about people with disabilities and getting to places. And, you know, you needed a law that would mandate accessibility for handicapped people because we had to literally carry him in his wheelchair up and down those stairs. And it was a tight staircase. It was not easy.
Another basement dweller from my Hofstra years was Tom Curley. Tom is now a director at CBS News. He went from being a minor apparatchik at WVHC to the pinnacle of Hofstra radio student jobs.
I remember I was the chief announcer when I was a freshman, And then the next year, I don't know, I might have been something. But then, yeah, then I was the program director my junior year, and then senior year as the station manager.
Years after leaving Hofstra, and after the radio station had moved to posh new studios, Tom Curley learned a shocking secret about the old WVHC studios.
We were in the basement of the little theater, which oddly enough, even I never knew until long after I left. We were in that entire room was condemned by the fire department. Legally, we could not work down there. They just never noticed, and it was never reported. And long after it was closed, I remember Jeffrey one day mentioned, that was always condemned. We were never allowed to build it there.
All the Hofstra radio people I know remember Jeff Krause as a master broadcaster, a mentor, and a teacher. Less appreciated was the fact that he was also a master bureaucrat. He had to keep the radio station afloat while a hostile university administration would have been happy to shut it down. Jeff created University Broadcast Services, which would do audio recordings in and around the Hofstra campus for modest sums of money, which were then channeled through a bank account in the Cayman Islands back to the radio station to do things like purchase blank audio tape. We'll talk about the unending thirst for audio tape in a few minutes. Jeffrey the bureaucrat also had to find a way to control and shape the dozens of Hofstra students and people from the community that were the radio station staff. Tom Curley has an interesting take.
Look, the radio station was, we were Animal House. We were the fraternity that wasn't a fraternity. We would take in all the flotsam and jetsam and the weird people and the wackos and give them something to do, give them something to look forward to, and gave a lot of them careers.
So how did Jeff Krause deal with this collection of misfits and weirdos? He created the radio station's own bureaucracy. There was an administrative board and an executive board, and those august bodies remain in place to this very day. During my time at Hofstra, as you may have noticed, everybody got a title. Kev Riley explains.
In the absence of actual salaries, because nobody was paid back then, a title went a long way toward making you feel like what you were doing at the radio station was worthwhile. I can't remember how many titles I had over the 4+ years I spent at Hofstra Radio. I think my first title was News Operations Director, and was I Classical Music Director at one point?
You were.
It's hard to remember.
Okay. If you were paying close attention, you may recall I said this was a documentary about public affairs radio. So what's the deal with public affairs radio? I asked Kev Riley.
In an earlier age when the Federal Communications Commission was more public-oriented, there was an obligation by stations to produce programming in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. They had to do public affairs programs as the cost of doing business. So they were generally on commercial stations relegated to the ghetto of Sunday morning right after sign-on.
At Hofstra Radio in the early 70s, public affairs shows weren't just on the air to satisfy the FCC, as Tom Curley explained.
You got to understand back then, there was a thing called the Fairness Doctrine. Every radio station had to produce a certain amount of public affairs programming to be able to keep its FCC license. Educational stations had to produce a larger percentage of that in order to keep their license. On top of that, you had our general manager, Jeff Krause, who actually firmly believed in all this stuff, that, that this station actually had to have diversity and do different things. And also, it was for many cases for Jeffrey, it was a revenue producer. It was either a revenue producer or it was a way to kiss up to somebody that was going to become a revenue producer.
During my Hofstra years and for a couple years afterwards, I was the public affairs department of a successful Suffolk County commercial radio station. My job involved taking tapes produced elsewhere and playing them. Commercial radio stations didn't want to be bothered to produce public affairs programs, so a variety of organizations and government agencies would produce and send out programs in the hopes of advancing their agendas.
The Department of Public Affairs of this station in cooperation with the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, presents the award-winning Adventures in Judaism, relating the classic traditions of the Jewish religion to the problems and experiences of our day. Today's program is In My Father's Court, featuring readings of excerpts from Isaac Bashevis Singer's Book of Memoirs and an interview with the author. And now here is our host for the series, Rabbi Balfour Brickner, Director of Interfaith Activities for the UAHC. Rabbi Brickner.
Welcome to another adventure in Judaism.
On the agricultural scene with Frank Walkley, Commissioner of the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets.
One thing that could be said about the weather conditions for farmers in New York State in 1972 is that it was an unusual year. Adverse weather conditions and the Hurricane Agnes both contributed toward sharp differences in the crop productions in New York State this year. With me is Bill Baer of the New York State Crop Reporting Service, who can tell us some of the effects of the weather conditions and also just what the full job of the Crop Reporting Service is. Bill?
Well, Commissioner, the Crop Reporting Service is a joint state-federal activity. We collect information from farmers and dealers reflecting the crop production in New York State.
As a parent, what can you do if your child is arrested? A list of 25 pertinent questions is reviewed in Today's Education, Journal of the National Education Association. Some of the questions were covered in our last panorama report, and today we look at the remainder. The author, attorney Neil L. Chayot, points out that if one's child is arrested, quick action is important. The first thing to do is to get a lawyer without delay, he advises. This is essential, regardless of how unnecessary it may seem. What attitude should the parents take toward the child who has been arrested? Obviously, anger is not productive at all, says Attorney Chayot.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of.
This is Christian in Action. Today, the National Catholic Office of Radio and Television, in cooperation with this station's Public Affairs Department, presents an encounter with God through people and their music. Your host, Reverend Edmund Nadalny.
Thank you. Time is so important to a marriage. Where are you in the time of your marriage? The Chicago speaks of the beginnings of marriage. The grassroots wonder what will happen to a marriage whose time is sooner or later. Finally, Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds worry about the time of your marriage when you are tempted, as they sing, Don't Pull Your Love.
Some of these shows were so bad, you wondered if any station used them. Tom Curley and I knew that there was another reason for these programs to exist.
There was tons of those things out there back then.
I actually have a couple examples of them.
Yeah, I mean, they, you
because
know,
what they were also good for is blank tape.
Oh, absolutely. Don't Laugh. There was a lot of those shows that Jeff, that we did order for exactly that reason. You didn't have to send the tape back, and you got yourself one brand new reel of reel-to-reel tape. Only used once. Bribery always did do that.
The quest for audio tape. Virtually every program produced at WVHC that wasn't live was recorded on quarter-inch magnetic audio tape. Every Hofstra radio person I know from my era has boxes and boxes of it somewhere in an attic, and nothing to play it on. And we each have a beautiful machined aluminum splicing block, which was used with a razor blade to physically edit the tape. There was never enough recording tape, and this situation gave rise to one of the great WVHC urban legends. Here's Howard Liberman's version of it.
We had the last known interview of Albert Einstein that I don't remember if it was Jeff Krause that had done it or who, but someone, the Hofstra had this tape, and it was the last interview known to man of Einstein before he passed away. One day, the sports guys needed a tape to make a tape of the football game broadcast they were doing. So, you know, tape was hard to come by. We didn't have lots of boxes and boxes of new tape, and you would often reuse something that was old. But if it said Albert Einstein interview on it, you would think someone would say, hey, can I use this? Well, apparently they didn't go through that step. They just used it. And then CBS, I believe, called Jeff Krause to say, we understand you have the last known interview of Albert Einstein, and we'd like to use it in this special we're doing. So Jeff went to the archive room, got the box out, came out, put it on the tape recorder, and we heard these bozos calling a bad football game rather than Albert Einstein. As I recall, that's the Albert Einstein story.
Tom Curley's recollection is similar, but not exactly the same.
Jeffrey had the last recorded interview with Albert Einstein. He recorded him, and he died. And everybody wanted it, and he went to the archives to get it, and he put it up on the tape machine, and somebody recorded a football game over it. Jeffrey was not happy.
A great story, sure, but probably not true. Albert Einstein died in 1955. Thanks, Wikipedia. Jeff Krause was 16 years old in 1955. And while Hofstra had a carrier current radio station in 1955, it seems far-fetched that anyone from the carrier current station would have the resources to record an interview with Einstein. Tape recorders were commercially available in 1955, but they were pretty rare and quite pricey. Remarkably, I've heard a number of versions of this story. Longtime WVHC chief engineer Ted Ronneberger supplies the size of the reel of tape, 5 inches as opposed to the standard 7-inch reel. And Ted claims it was a sports show, which he can actually name, rather than a football game. I did learn that at some point in the far distant past, CBS gave the Hofstra radio station a large amount of used recording tape. We can't rule out the possibility that the story has its genesis there. Someone could have erased an interview, the historic last known interview, that CBS had recorded with Einstein. 2 facts remain unchanged regardless of which version of the Einstein interview story you hear. First, it was the last known recorded interview with Albert Einstein. And second, the sports guys destroyed it forever by recording over it. The story serves to underscore what every sports-hating WVHC guy knew. That sports guys are dumbasses.
Good evening and welcome to the second show in our series on Hofstra Sports. This one is on sports publicity. I'm Todd Schwartz and I'll be moderating this show, and I'd like to introduce our panelists. First, the Hofstra Sports Information Director.
You cut that.
Good evening and welcome to this second part in our series on Hofstra Sports. This show is entitled Sports Publicity on the Hofstra Campus. I'm Todd Schwartz and I'll be moderating this show. Our panelists, first, Hofstra Sports Information Director Ron Carroll. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd. Pleasure to be here.
Also, we have Pat Cole.
That's my fault.
Good evening and welcome to this second show in our series on Hofstra Sports, this one entitled Sports. I don't know. Good evening and welcome in this second. Okay, we'll take it again. Good evening. Good evening and welcome to part 2 in our series on Hofstra Sports, this one entitled Sports Publicity. Our panelists, first, Mr. Ron Carroll, Hofstra Sports Information Director. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Todd. It's a pleasure to be here.
Todd!
Good evening and welcome to part...
Hofstra Radio in the early 1970s, pretty much the Algonquin roundtable of the air. Todd Schwartz is now an editor on the sports desk at Newsday, and probably not a dumbass. If there ever was an Einstein interview, and if the sports guys really did erase it, this wasn't the first time such a thing happened. Here's Kev Riley.
There's a phrase that I've used time and again in television, especially, that the sausage grinder needs meat, and that we constantly are throwing out yesterday's program to cram in the newest stuff for today's, and cannibalizing the archives for recording tape to record the new shows on has happened time and again in broadcasting history. The most notorious episode I can think of, aside from your Einstein story, happened to Johnny Carson. The entire first few years of his hosting of The Tonight Show, when it was based in New York, is lost to history because some NBC official decided that they didn't need to take up all that storage space for old stuff, and they re-recorded programs on those old tapes. So all that stuff was gone.
Some of you may be asking, but Steve, what about all those great WVHC public affairs shows from the early 70s? We're going to discuss some of them when I return. Please stay tuned. Thanks for coming back. It's time to talk about public affairs shows at WVHC. The typical public affairs program was and is a bunch of people sitting in front of microphones talking in real time. Cheap and easy, and often not very good. That kind of program's much higher-toned sibling is the radio documentary. They were time-consuming and cumbersome to produce, particularly in the days before digital editing, when cut and paste really meant cut and paste. Kev Riley did the only radio documentary I recall being produced at WVHC during my years there.
One of the professors at the college, Louis Lomax, a history professor, had died in a car crash, and Jeff Krause suggested that perhaps we might want to do a documentary in tribute to the life of this distinguished black educator. And we decided to do the life of Louis Lomax. And we were surprised the more we researched his life, how little we knew about him. But he intersected with a lot of famous people in broadcasting. So 2 months into my career at Hofstra Radio, we started doing this documentary, and we got to interview everybody from Percy Sutton, who was the Manhattan Borough president, to Mike Wallace, who at that time was the co-host of 60 Minutes with Harry Reasoner. It was a relatively new show back in 1971. And we went to the CBS broadcast facility on 57th and 10th Avenue, what they used to call the old bottling plant. It used to be a board and milk plant. And sat down in a tiny office with Mike Wallace, whose career at CBS was just really starting at that point. And we brought a big old Ampex recorder with us that was about the size of a suitcase, propped it up on the corner of his relatively small desk, and started asking him questions. And at one point, asking him a question about his work with Louis Lomax on a documentary about black Muslims, he put his hand over the microphone and said, "Bullshit." I said, "What?" He says, "You know, the question you just asked me has no validity. It's bullshit." And I realized that here I was, 2 months of experience in radio under my narrow belt at that time, asking perhaps the greatest inquisitor in broadcast history a question that he felt was insufficiently prepared because I hadn't done the research that he thought Louis Lomax deserved. So I rephrased the question and got the answer that I wanted from it. Mike Wallace did occasional documentaries, and one of them was called The Hate That Hate Produced. And Louis Lomax was his guide to the world of black Muslims. And Mike Wallace really didn't have entree to the black community, being a white guy in a tie, and Louis Lomax was his ally in that. And they got all kinds of awards and honors for this show. It was probably the first time on American television that anybody had heard of Malcolm X, Minister Farrakhan, any of those people. So when we started doing this program, it was like one of my favorite movies, Citizen Kane, where the more you ask about this guy whose life was suddenly and tragically taken away from us, the more you find that he might not have been the white knight in shining armor that you thought he was. We produced this program, Louis Lomax. I think it was in two parts, 2.5 hours. And Jeffrey Krause entered it in a competition, an award competition for the National Association of FM Broadcasters. And we got the honorable mention that year for the documentary. One of the judges called it a jewel of a portrait, a phrase I'll never forget. And lo and behold, they invited us to go to Chicago to pick up this award at the broadcasting convention. So fly to Chicago, they put us up in the Palmer House, which is a fancy schmancy hotel, and we get to pick up this award. It was a magnificent experience for someone just starting out in radio. And kind of like Orson Welles, I never got another award like that in more than 30 years in broadcasting. I got mine early, 2 months in, and it was probably the most satisfying work I've ever done, and is some of the first work I ever did as a broadcast journalist.
You did a show on WVHC called On Mic. What was that all about?
That was essentially a couple of guys sitting around a table talking into microphones. The very first guest I had on Mic was Alphonse D'Amato, who at that time was assistant supervisor of the town of Hempstead.
He was the supervisor of the town of Hempstead. Before the Nassau County Legislature came into existence, the town of Hempstead had a presiding supervisor, who at that time was Francis T. Purcell, and it had a supervisor. When they eliminated the Board of Supervisors, they eliminated the role of supervisor and just had a presiding supervisor.
Already? So with the first guest was Al D'Amato, who then, as probably not quite now, but relatively recently, easy to get him to be a guest. If anybody crapped out at the last minute, anybody canceled out, you could always call Al D'Amato. Two guys sitting around a table talking about public issues is the cheapest and perhaps lowest form of public affairs journalism. This show was it. We went in with noble intentions, but we did it as easily as we could, which was... get a guest who can talk about an issue in the public eye and sit around the table and fill half an hour with it, and that we did.
In the early 70s, WVHC aired a large number of public affairs shows, some produced in-house, some provided by outside parties. Some featured student talent, others featured non-students. One show hosted by a non-student but produced at Hofstra was the previously discussed Exploring Management. The Administrative Management Society promoted the application of management methods for commerce and industry for the purpose of increasing productivity, lowering costs, and improving quality. It encouraged and participated in research while promoting sound employer-employee relations. What does that mean? I have no idea. Maybe you can garner some information from program titles. In November of 1971, topics of discussion included Other People's Children, Parts 5 and 6, and Exploring Leadership Skills. Today, these shows might be better suited to podcasts. There was a niche for them, however, no matter how tiny, and WVHC was happy to fill it. WVHC did air some public affairs programs we got from outside sources, like the Nassau County Reports.
Happy anniversary to you, happy anniversary to you, happy anniversary, dear Mesba, happy anniversary to you. No, it's not Andy Williams, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ralph Queso, Nassau County Executive, and I'm singing happy birthday to my good friend Andrew Chavone, because it's just about a year ago this time that he took over this very sensitive operation of the Metropolitan Suburban Bus Authority, known fondly as MESBA, to help us to establish a better bus system in Nassau County.
Former WVHC program director and station manager Tom Curley.
Nassau County Reports with County Executive Ralph Queso. Right. That was a deal, you know. You did these things. One, it filled up a half hour. Two, it got you in good with the government. Three, it made you look good with the county, with the administration, because look, we're doing all this public affairs stuff, you know, and they loved it because basically Ralph Queso could come in and, you know,
push whatever propaganda he wanted for a half hour, which was fine.
Some WVHC shows dealt with campus issues. Rappin' with Dean Luiso featured Hofstra Dean of Students Sal Luiso. Tom Curley remembers, sort of.
Sal was, basically you'd let him go and pontificate on whatever he wanted to pontificate on each week. And he was pretty much probably pushing whatever, community program that he wanted to.
Well, wasn't he the young hip?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sal was the young hip. He was supposed to be the hip dean, I mean, okay, he was young.
And the name of his show was Rappin'.
Rappin' was, yeah, exactly. Well,
do you remember, was it R-A-P-P-I-N-G or was it I-N apostrophe?
It would have to be R-A-P-P-I-N, Rapping with Sal, that would be just way too grammatically correct.
Neither Tom nor I could remember many of the details of this program. I did remember that Dean Luiso put a black mark on my permanent record that haunts me to this day. Howard Liberman, then a student, hosted a show that explored campus life during the 1973-1974 academic year.
We tried to, make it subject specific, and it was, gay rights on campus or the one where some of the people I knew from the dorms who were living together. There was, a show about that. It was college topics. We were trying to make it of interest to the student body, even though I assumed most people were not listening unless their friend was on.
Something I now find amusing is that Howard's show was the radio precursor to having your mom and dad stumble upon stuff you didn't want them to know on your MySpace page. The topic? Cohabitation. The guests, students, living in sin.
This particular couple, they were using pseudonyms because they didn't want anybody to know it was them. And I went along with that. But they would inadvertently use their real names in the discussion. So it was pretty obvious that it was Joni and Andy we were talking about were their names. But they actually did stay together. They got married. They live in Wayne, New Jersey. They've got kids and, a wonderful life. So that worked out. But in those days, I mean, if the girl's parents were calling, there were all sorts of lies that roommates would tell. And there were very elaborate things set up so that they wouldn't know that she was with the boyfriend. And, it was at a stage where, living together like that was
living together
not
in
something
sin, out of wedlock.
Yeah, as it were.
Then not acceptable. Now
no, not
so
acceptable
much.
Then. But it was cutting edge public affairs programming, if you will.
Howard did another show on another hot topic on campus, homosexuality, which was then new and trendy. Here's that Kev Riley guy.
I went on the show and basically told Howard and our listening audience that I was gay.
And in fact, it's how I found out that you were gay. I thought you just liked cats.
Howard Liberman was also surprised by Kevin's Doogie Howser moment.
It was I guess, a surprise to me when I realized that Kevin was gay. He talked about doing the show. He thought it was important. So he was the big surprise special guest. I guess that was the first time he, admitted his sexuality in public.
In the early 70s, WVHC had only one studio, which was used on the air and for teaching of courses. Public affairs shows were often recorded in other places. Among those who became adept at schlepping tons of equipment was Howard Liberman.
We did one that Dave Levy actually did the interviews, and I was the engineer, and that was always done outside because we were talking to politician Saul Wachler. I remember sitting down in his office at the courthouse with Dave, and I was rolling the tape, and he talked with Wachler, a lot of local politicians.
Saul Wachler was at one time the chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals. David Levy went from interviewing politicians to being one. He served in the United States Congress, and he did not respond to requests that he participate in this program. Dave Levy wasn't the only guy that interviewed politicians. I was always amazed by the willingness of local politicos to be interviewed in depth by a college radio station. In 1972, I did four half-hour programs called Election 72 Ex Post Facto. I interviewed the Nassau County heads of the Republican, Democratic, Liberal, and Conservative parties. These programs are long gone, but with the help of Howard Liberman, I was able to do a dramatic reenactment of part of one of them.
Mr. Margiotta, this past election, the 1972 election, saw Richard Nixon elected, with winning 49 of the states, and virtually all of the incumbent Republicans here in Nassau County have been reelected. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I bet you thought that was awesome, huh?
Absolutely.
Remember, that was not an actual recording, only a dramatic reenactment. Was I really that bad an interviewer? I'm not sure. During the time I was at Hofstra Radio, we were, from time to time, able to produce compelling radio merely by recording an event otherwise going on the Hofstra campus. Kev Riley remembers.
There was actually a program called A Voice for All, and it used Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man as its theme music. That was one of the public affairs shows we did that was designed to give a soapbox to people of various political and social views. And I think it's a tribute to the station's mandate, mission, and to Jeff Krause in particular, that we felt like, as a community radio station for the Hofstra community, but the larger Hempstead and Long Island community, that we really had a chance to do something different. Because all the other radio stations on Long Island rarely did any public affairs programming. They never did anything controversial. And we were willing to put on abortion advocates and First Amendment free speech people and anti-war activists. And we had some great shows. I produced a couple of three of those, I'm sure.
Some shows we did at WVHC took advantage of our association with a bastion of academic excellence. Tom Curley produced one such show.
I had read in the Hofstra paper that a biology teacher, that was one of my biology teachers, had gotten a grant for $80,000, which back then was a lot of money. He got a grant from the government for $80,000 to study mite-infested periodontal disease in bats, to which I went, he's got $80,000 to study cavities in bat teeth. Well, I thought this was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. So, being very serious, telling him who I was from the radio station, he didn't even remember that I was a student of his, I interviewed him. And I'm absolutely on the level, absolutely serious. I asked him all sorts of serious questions about, and he talked all about his studies and how mite-infested periodontal disease is very important. And I must have gotten an hour interview out of him. And I was always a big fan of shows that are all form and no substance. So I created a multi-part series called Academic Forum. And it had five intros and five outros. Okay? There was, Jeffrey would do Academic Forum, and then another announcer would come in, you know, where we study the topics that you need to know about. This week, episode one of, you know, we interview Dr. So-and-so who's studying mite-infested periodontal disease in bats, and the way the thing worked was, today we ask him the question, are studies about bat teeth important? And he would say, yes, studies about bat teeth are important. In other words, we would say exactly what he was going to say. He'd say one sentence, and then we'd go to five outros. The whole thing was 5 minutes long. There was literally 10 seconds of content in the entire thing.
Academic Forum was actually a show within a show and was featured on the fabulously funny radio program Fulton's Folly. Fulton's Folly was comedy, but never forget what Sigmund Freud said about jokes. A while ago, I mentioned something about a bird in a top hat perched on top of a microphone. Although it appeared on the program guide that I edited, on stickers that ended up on WVHC equipment, and on WVHC tape labels, I never knew that the bird had a name. But Kev Riley knew the bird's name.
It was just the lore of the station, the Grok bird. It was the graphical mascot of WVHC. It looked like a parakeet with a top hat, if memory serves me.
For those of you keeping a scorecard at home, that's GROK, G-R-O-K. On the WVHC program guide, the GROK bird had the German words, Die Gedanken sind frei. Turns out that means, roughly, thoughts are free. It's the title of a German song adopted by the anti-Nazi resistance in Germany during World War II, and later recorded by Pete Seeger in the 1960s. In other places, the words, a voice for all, appear over the bird. These words are pretty self-explanatory. But why Grok bird? It was an easier mystery to crack than Rosebud. The bird was created by Jeff Krause's then-wife, Marilyn, in the 1960s, and Grok was a Martian word that turned up in the seminal science fiction novel Stranger in a Strange Land. It roughly means understand. Understanding, free thought, a voice for all, really not difficult stuff to understand. And it's not difficult to understand how these concepts apply to a lot of the stuff we were doing at WVHC in the early 70s, even if we didn't always appreciate it at the time. Once again, Kev Riley.
WVHC was one of the only places where you could hear discussions of local issues of interest to Long Islanders, because New York City stations didn't care. The handful of commercial stations on the island that even did any local news coverage hardly did any public affairs programming beyond a five-minute newscast at the top of the hour. So our station was one of the only public forums for a serious discussion of public issues. And this, at the time we worked there, Steve and I, at the height of the Vietnam War, there was a lot of controversial ground to cover, politically, locally, and nationally.
Wes Richards.
I must confess, I'm sorry to say, I was never a huge listener, any more than I was a huge participant. But the idea of the station being there and being a part of the community and being a part of the college, that was always a very satisfying notion, as long as I didn't have to do any work.
So, WVHC in the early 70s, nurturing broadcasters, doing the kinds of programs commercial stations couldn't be bothered to do. To me, as to thousands of other members of the Hofstra community, WVHC was always about Jeff Krause. Did Jeff ever want to cross over to the other side, from non-commercial radio to the big bucks of major market or network broadcasting? Again, Wes Richards.
The only time he talked about that was when those of us who knew him and respected his talent, which was pretty much everybody who knew him, because it was an enormous talent, would ride him for not doing it. Why aren't you at WCBS? Why aren't you at WHLI? Why aren't you? Why aren't you? Why aren't you? And he would always mumble and give some weasel excuse. And Jeff had a great trick, as many pipe smokers did. It was pause to play with, light, fill, relight, refill the pipe before answering a question when he didn't want to answer. Hoping, I guess, that you'd go away, and finally inviting you to go away if he didn't like the question. But no, he never really expressed an interest in it. He said he liked what he was doing, and he felt that he was doing more good there than he was than he would be if he were, you know, just another one of us working grunts.
Tom Curley suggests that sometimes Jeff Krause didn't understand the impact he'd had on others, and sometimes he did.
What Jeff never understood, you know, we had this conversation years later, many, many, many times over. You know, Jeff stayed at the station and, you know, forego a career at the networks, could have had one, did have one. And, you know, always felt that, you know, all the people that went on, you know, were somehow more successful than him. And I used to say, you know, you really don't get it. You are the reason that all these people are in the media. The number of people that you launched, the number of people that you inspired, the number of people that you taught, what you've got is so much better and so much more important and so much more impressive. What he did was, you know, so much more profound and, you know, and in the long run, I think, you know, much better. And sometimes he got it and sometimes he did.
A lot of talk about 50 years of Hofstra Radio has been about all the radio alumni who ended up with careers in broadcasting. I think that's only part of the story. I worked in Long Island radio for a couple of years after graduating, and then went to law school, because that's what Jewish sons do. But during my years at Hofstra, I learned more than how to edit tape and write broadcast copy. My mentor and my friend, Jeffrey Krause, taught me more valuable lessons, like how to work with people, how to work around people when necessary, and how to always be true to myself. Thanks for joining me. I hope you'll join me again for the 75th anniversary of Hofstra Radio. For the 75 project, I will examine great public service announcements of the early 70s.
Man can go for weeks without water.
Weeks days without food. Days without water, but only minutes without air.
They're complaining and complaining and complaining, and nobody do nothing
about that. Oh, right. Those are great.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.